All right. So, sex and spirituality. What could sex and religion possibly have in common, besides the fact that even hardcore atheists scream out, "Oh God, oh God, oh God"? Probably not an accident. A certain amount of celebration, of ecstasy. Nothing fills the pews like a sermon on sex. Sex is kind of a prerequisite for you all being here. I'm not talking about the topic as kind of the lost leader to drag you in under false pretenses, but the fact is, almost all of us got here because of some kind of sex act. There might be a few test tube babies, but for the most part, somebody somewhere might have had a good time. And sex and religion have always had a relationship, and it's often been ambivalent and in tension. Religions starting out as primitive families and tribes and communities wanted to increase their number, and they didn't need to have a scientific understanding of procreation to notice after a few millennia the cause and effect relationship that seemed to exist between sex and pregnancy. And when I get into the issues of some of the laws and the taboos, you'll see that religion is really very much, in terms of its laws and mores, about growing the community. Religions that are not for growing the community tend to have the fate of Shakers. The RE program goes away, and there's no new generation of children, because this act is an act that increases the tribe. So when religions looked at all of this stuff, strangely, they, for the most part, celebrate sex and sexuality. They're a little afraid of love. Love, and I know that's counterintuitive, but love is considered to be more dangerous. Love might increase the tribe, but it also brings down the throne. When the biblical patriarch Jacob fell in love lust with Rachel, that was taking things out of order. The dad wasn't asked. Leah was standing by saying, "My clock is ticking, 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 and I'm supposed to dance at my sister's wedding." But passion overtook him, and he went out of order. Passion overtook David, just about every other chapter. And it wasn't simply the passion to mate. It was also the passion to get the husband of the woman he lusted after killed. This is generally considered on so many levels to be wrong. And even as a Unitarian Universalist, I'm saying I got less trouble with lust, but getting the object of your affections partner killed just seems to be transgressive somehow. And yet he remained beloved of God. Almost every religion deals with kind of a sense of that separation of the sacred and the profane. How shall we celebrate and how shall we control the issues of sex and sexuality? As I indicated, when you look at the religious mores, you're looking at laws that were meant to be conception efficient. If you were not supposed to, pardon the word, masturbate, because I can't really say abuse yourself, that just seems like the wrong word. You're not supposed to masturbate, you were not supposed to waste your seed. They believed you only had a finite amount of seed and desire, and if you wasted it, it wasn't going to be used well in making the tribe, the family, the society strong. When you look at the laws against homosexuality, they're based on the same premise. They didn't need an awful lot of scientific understanding to get that homosexuality was not conception efficient. It no matter how hard you tried, it just didn't seem to result in growing the tribe. The same thing is true for having sexual intercourse during the period. And when in Jewish law, a woman is not supposed to have intercourse during the period and then is supposed to wait and then is supposed to go to the ritual baths, the mikveh, and then wait till the Sabbath, then you understand that by this time everybody is ready. And the sacramental act of sexual congress is going to be much more likely to be conception efficient. In fact, it is. While some religions think of sex as dirty, and I'll get to why sex is dirty, the answer is only if you do it right, but think of sex as dirty, on the Sabbath, an Orthodox Jew is pretty much commanded to perform the sacrament of making love. You're not allowed to work. You're not allowed to cook. You're not allowed to light a fire except in the bedroom. And so it's not a sin. It's a sacrament under the right conditions for the community and for the growth of the community. Now, how did sex get to be dirty? Robin Williams has a very good explanation of one of the several reasons. One, it was an evolutionary mistake on the part of whoever created us for evolution. And that was why he asked the question. This way I don't have to take responsibility for what I'm about to say. He said, obviously the problem was that God located the waste elimination plant next to the park and the playground. And that just seems to get people mixed up and confused. The second reason, Robin Williams incidentally got a better laugh on that, but probably his delivery. The second reason is that you're vulnerable. When one, or preferably two, make love, there's every chance that you're not going to be fully dressed. There's going to be a pretty good chance that you're not going to be vertical. And that means that you are going to be prey for jealous lovers, for animals, for all kinds of situations. So how do you get people to assume, I think, what Winston Churchill called a inherently undignified position? There's got to be a powerful reason for doing that. And that powerful reason is, of course, pleasure. If sex were not fun, probably no one would do it. I mean, you wouldn't have to control it. You wouldn't have to write all kinds of laws and prohibitions trying to restrict it. One of the great rules of understanding the Bible, or understanding even civic law and civil law, is if people don't do it, you don't have to write laws forbidding it. So when you go through all of the laws and the injunctions around sex and sexuality, you can figure out that people are doing all of those things that are being controlled and forbidden and done anyway, but with just a certain amount of guilt to it. Some religions celebrated sex very openly. In Greek religion, there were temple prostitutes. Again, that gets forbidden in the Hebrew Bible and in the Christian scriptures, but it doesn't have to be forbidden if nobody was doing it. You have today, when you hear some people talking about marriage, biblical marriage is between one man and one woman. No, that's not what the scriptures say. Biblical marriage is between one man and pretty much as many women as he could afford. And then you have concubines, and then you have all kinds of other things. And even the adultery statute within the framework of Old Testament law was only adultery if the woman is married. If the man is married, it's not adultery. I see people converting en masse even as I speak. This is all powerful stuff. And the way that religion deals with some of the ambivalence and of it being dirty is that you have in Hinduism, in Buddhism, higher chakras and lower chakras. In classic Orthodox Judaism, you have a Havdalah, separation between above the waist and below the waist. Our religions and many of our philosophies, for the philosophy students back there, are based on the idea that there is the spiritual, the ideal, the eternal, and then there's the body, that sack of flesh that gets old, that deteriorates, that just runs out of time, and that we should honor the greater spiritual part. But in order to do that, you got to have another generation. A lot of people, I believe, mistakenly think that religion is fundamentally a neurotic way of dealing with our fear of death, that religion is all about death. I don't think that's true. I think religion is all about fertility, and fertility is our way of dealing with death because it sends our genes into a limitless future. That's how we send our genes forward in time on the body level, and on the spiritual level, whatever it is that you believe, whether from Genesis, where God breathes the spirit of life into the nostrils of Adam, and Ecclesiastes, where it goes back in the final breath, as what is not defined. But those two parts of us, body and soul, were always seeking some kind of union. Indeed, when Paul talked about everybody knows what's going to happen on the wedding night after the relationship has been sacralized in a church, a synagogue, an ashram, a mosque, we know that they're going to go from that holy site and go and do it. Well, that's increasingly less true. Over 30% of marriages are not consummated on the wedding night because they were consummated 6 years before. And on the wedding night, they're just too tired and hungover and full. And I'll see you in the morning and, you know, see, and we'll see what happens. That the sacrament of marriage used to be a learner's permit to get a sexual driver's license. And that certainly isn't true anymore. And so many people are doing it without benefit of clergy, which I object to, but not so much on moral grounds as on selfish grounds, because I charge retail, and I definitely have a dog in that fight. But religion celebrates that mystic union. When you read Song of Songs, it's earthy, it's sexual, it's sensual. The rabbinic take on it was, it's God's love for Israel. The Christian take is, it's Christ's love for his church. It is both earthy and spiritual, as is or can be lovemaking. Lovemaking. We understand that sex is fun, but the ideal of making love is, most would agree, on a higher level. It's seeking to an intimation of the joining of body and soul. And in the joining of bodies, to disappear for a moment from the ego, from the conscious, into a mystical moment of ecstasy and annihilation all at the same time, of creating and destroying all at the same time for one uncapturable moment that is an intimation for most religions of the ideal and the divine and the permanent that may be available to those believers. It becomes an act and a metaphor all at the same time. Religion has got to deal with issues of sex and sexuality. It looks for ways of trying to tame the wild, uncontrolled, and sometimes destructive impulses, see David, and to celebrate the beautiful, the intimate, the vulnerable in body and vulnerable in spirit to each other that is possible from time to time. It is, if we believe it, whether sending our genes into the future, it is an intimation of a certain kind of mortality, a certain kind of immortality, of a timelessness in those moments. When I was very, very young, I'm going to go back to the timeless for a moment, my father had a store, and one of our stock boys, we called them stock boys back then, was a student at Caltech. And I was about 6 or 7 years old, and I asked him, I understand only 3 people understand the theory of relativity. And he said, no, a lot more people than that. And I said, well, can you explain it to me? And he looks at me and says, yes, I can. And I'll explain it to you today, and you'll understand it in 5 years. And I said, okay. He said, if you sit on a stove for a second, it will seem like forever. And if a pretty girl sits on your lap for a minute, it will seem like a second. And which made no sense to a 6 or 7 or 8 year old. But when I got to be 13, I understood the theory of relativity and the issue of time and the timeless moment when ideally bodies and souls joined together for an instant of openness, of vulnerability, of love, of celebration, of commitment to each other, and a kind of commitment to the future. Because without sex, you're not here, and without sex, nobody's here in the future. And while some religions have tried to go out of business, and famously in the Kreutzer Sonata, the ideal was to give up sex and let humanity fade away. That seems like a difficult goal to achieve, if you want to achieve that at all. And that some believe that you give the gift of your sexuality to some higher power, and that has the results of taking, in theory, the best and the brightest out of the gene pool. So the ultimate message of religion is to celebrate our sexuality and ourselves, to understand that the celebration started in terms of growing the tribe and has expanded to joining together and growing our hearts, growing our relationships, growing our consciousness of the preciousness of the other, and finding that other as naked, as vulnerable, as imperfect, as beautiful as anything else in the world. When we make love that goes beyond ourselves.